From the heart of the Oregon wine country, you're listening to Season 7 of the Wine Crush Podcast. Stories uncorked for wine enthusiasts around the world, featuring winemakers from the Willamette Valley and beyond. Sponsored by Country Financial. From origin stories to terroir, here's your host, Heidi Moore.
Hey everybody, welcome to Wine Crush Podcast. We are season 7, episode 2, and we are back with an international flair again. This time is just kind of is a theme almost already, and I'm loving every bit of it. And so we have France represented today, we have Japan represented today, and New York isn't completely international in form, but we got New York on the charter too. So anyhow, we're going to start with Mark with Domaine 524. So everybody grab your wine. Pour whatever it is that you want to drink. Grab a snack, sit back, and we are going to leave for France. So, Mark, thank you so very much for joining. And this has been a little bit of a whirlwind for you because you don't live in Oregon.
I do not.
We have to catch you in between flights.
Alaska and I are very good friends. Lots of miles.
Wine flies free.
Yes, it does. Two cases every time I go back.
Perfect. There you go. You got to take it when you got it. So, hinted that we're heading to France today because your background and your upbringing is over there. And admittedly, my French is very, very poor. Mrs. Cooley at Tillamook High School will be very glad to know that I still know how to say my name. I can find the corner of the street and I still know the French song about dismembering a bird. And I don't know why I know that. And I think that's what the lyrics are.
Dismembering a bird. I don't know that I know that
song.
Yeah,
I'll sing it for you later. Another couple glasses of wine and I can tell you all about the Alouette. So let's start with your story because, again, people don't always come from the wine industry. And
We do not.
Yes.
My father was in the military.
And it's always a good beginning of the story.
Yep. And as he says, 7 of the 8 guys he played Pinochle with married French women. And my mom was one of those. I spent every summer growing up in France. My grandfather had a couple men's clothing stores, and I sold all the stuff that he couldn't put on sale in the store at different markets around Brittany. He was very cheap, so he never wanted to have big sales in the store. So I spent my summers doing that and got to spend the afternoons on the beach, which was nice. And his best friend's son had a vineyard in the Loire in Cal de Chum. And it was organic and biodynamic before that was all popular. He's now a consultant for that in all of Europe and all over Europe. And I got to spend time with Francis and loved it. Loved everything about the wine, how he had a site that was big enough that he could do everything by hand. And I really fell in love with wine, spending time with him and learning to understand the process. And said to myself, someday in the future, I'm going to be able to come back over here and do something. I lived in New York for 14 years and started a family. And my wife and I decided to move back to Wisconsin, where we're both from. So the France dream went out the window. But for our 25th wedding anniversary, we came this way and spent some time in Oregon. And I loved it and told her, I'm going to buy a place here in the next couple of years. And she laughed at me, of course, and it took me about a year and a half. And I found a place across from my favorite vineyard at the time in Oregon, Temperance Hill. I can literally hit a wedge from my driveway into Temperance Hill. And we got 25 acres and we now have 11 under vine.
That's a whirlwind summary of your story.
It has to be quick, you know?
No, it doesn't have to be quick. We got 30 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a synopsis of Mark's trajectory from France to Wisconsin to Oregon. And I've never heard anybody use a wedge as a derivative of distance from one, you know, it's either throw a rock or...
I can't throw a rock that far, but I can't hit a wedge that far.
So what is that, about 150 yards or so?
I don't hit my wedge that far, maybe 125 yards.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's still a good wedge.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to France, because I think this is where the influential pieces of everything that you do and how you style your wine started. And I know there's a lot more to that story, because we rode around in the Gator on our tour through the vineyard after, I think he had to maybe jump start it once, it died on us, whatever. And so we spent a lot of time talking about France. And so let's talk about your mom and your grandparents and kind of that influence, whether it's food, it's wine, it's the language, and where that has shaped you, where you're at now.
It really shaped my appreciation for food and wine. We live a different lifestyle in the States. every morning when I'm in France, and I still go once or twice a year and spend time. Most of my family's gone now, but my godmother's still there, so we stay with my godmother. Every morning I walk to the bakery and the market and pick up stuff for breakfast and come back home. And every day after everybody's up, we walk back to the market and pick up what we're going to have for lunch. Now, the grocery store that we go to and where I live in Kenosha, Wisconsin, is about the same distance. In the whatever 20 plus years that I've lived there since I moved back from New York, I only walked once because I get in the car and I drive there. But in France, you walk there and you appreciate it. And nothing's wrapped in plastic. Everything's fresh. And there's just a different appreciation of food. You take the time to eat it. You take the time to enjoy it. And you take the time to enjoy the beverage that goes with it. You hear the stories, you know, when I was growing up, it was 18 in Wisconsin, but it's 21 now around the country. And kids getting stupid when they go off to college and turning 21 and whatever. In France, it doesn't happen because at the table in your teens, you're offered wine. You can cut it sometimes with water or you can have it straight, but you learn to appreciate it. You learn how it completes a meal, how it changes the experience. And it's not about having too much or doing anything silly. It's about appreciating the entire meal. And that stood with me and stayed with me. It's something that I really appreciate that my grandparents and my other relatives in France instilled in me and taught me. I like doing that on a daily basis, walking and buying fresh things and appreciating what we're going to pair them with. It's not just making a ham sandwich and running out the door. And
I mean, the time that I've spent in Europe, really as a whole, especially in France and Portugal and Spain and whatever, it is a much slower pace of life. And I love walking down to the bakery and I love walking to the market. And it's not always about drinking wine. It's having a cappuccino and a piece of cake in the afternoon. And it's just not frowned upon. And I was so excited about talking about food and wine with you because of those experiences. And I was just telling my husband yesterday that I think we just need to pack up and move to Europe. And I can get a really kick-ass house in Italy. And they may even pay me to come.
Oh, no, there's places that will. I now have grandchildren. So my life is ruined because I would, if I didn't have any, I could say goodbye to my children and see them only a couple times a year, but my grandkids, I can't. I would sell most of my possessions and move to a small place in the south of France and just walk to the bakery, the butcher, and wherever else I needed to go every day. But we live a different life here. You try to make it as much like it as you can, but it's difficult because of just our lifestyles and the distance between things in towns, where most European towns have very concentrated centers for commerce. In the United States, it's different. I may have told you this story. There was a great article. I also enjoy cigars as a bad thing. And there was a great article about Louis Tiant. It was a pitcher for the Red Sox. He defected and was able later to go back and visit his friends. And the writer they sent from Sports Illustrated to cover the story didn't smoke cigars. And Tiant said, well, then he can't come. So the guy said, well, I'm going to do it. And he went and spent 2 weeks in Cuba with Tiant. And twice a day, after lunch and after dinner, they sat for an hour, no phones, no work, no nothing, and had a cigar. With a coffee, as you mentioned, with a drink maybe after dinner. And they talked. And he came home and he said, and when he wrote in the article, he said, it was the best 2 hours of every day. Because it was, you were present, you were there, and the cigar was just ancillary. It was about being part of life and being present as opposed to just continuing to run through it.
It's such a special thing when you can actually sit down and actually enjoy that and be very in it, as you said. And I don't think we do it enough here. Americans in the U.S. as a whole are always at high speed. I am guilty 1,000,000%. My husband just had a talk with me about putting my phone down and paying attention. Not that he's any better, but it is true. It's taking the simplicity of what that is. I love it when my sister goes on vacation. She vacations a little bit more than I do. And I get pictures like three or four times a day of the cappuccinos that she's having and the slice of cake that she's, you know, whatever. And it's just, it takes you back to those beautiful breezes and you can enjoy the birds singing and the cobblestone and just the texture of where you're at.
Well, the simplest way for me is dinner. When you actually, you're not going back to work, you're there, you can have multiple courses. You can have multiple wines or beverages with each course. You don't have to put it all on the table and finish in 10 minutes and then clear and get up and go do the next thing. Mm-hmm. You can enjoy it and you can sit and you can talk. And those are the times that you discover things about each other, about whoever you're with. And they're the things that give you joy in life.
For sure. And so I'm interested with all of your time in France, you're growing up in France. What about Oregon was so appealing and why it drew you over here like it did?
It was very collegial. I love Pinot Noir. I love Burgundy, the whole region. I very much appreciate. And we came out here and loved the wine, first and foremost. Loved the wine, loved the character of the wine. I don't mean to speak ill of anyone, but I would much rather have an Oregon Pinot than a California Pinot. And I'll just leave it at that.
I won't comment.
So it was very collegial out here. I'm a hardcore capitalist. I was a trader in New York. I run a financial advisory firm now. The places I went around and talked at Bethel Heights with the Castile family, Mo Ayoub was very helpful. I'm just talking about planting, about doing different things in the vineyard and how you could do things and what you had to look out for. And they all spoke of, if I succeed, you succeed. The group succeeds. There was a real group mentality to it. And I like that. It reminded me of northern Wisconsin with hills. Okay, we have a little cabin in northern Wisconsin that we escape to occasionally. And it's just simpler. You know, we talk about that simple life and appreciating things. It's sitting on the back porch and making a pizza in a little pizza oven as opposed to, you know, ordering it and just going and picking it up. It's that simplicity of Oregon that I liked, really enjoyed the people and the attitude where it was friendly. It wasn't rushed. And I will say that excludes Portland a little bit because Portland is a city. But when you got out here in the valley, especially as you got out in where the vineyards are and the farms are, the people have a different perspective and flow to their lives. They're busy. They have things to do. Farming's incredibly difficult. You're working all day long, but there's a pace to it. And there's a perspective that maybe you don't get in Chicago or Portland or Seattle.
It's definitely a different way of life. And I think when you start dabbling in the farming aspect, it totally pulls you into even a deeper side of life that most don't experience, even superficially on the top. I mean, many people, you know, growing up in the dairy industry didn't know where the milk came from. They just thought it came from the grocery store. And so when you actually get into the farming aspect of it, get your hands dirty, get to asking questions about what these people are doing, it blew my mind. And whether you're organic or biodynamic or you're doing this great agriculture processing with sheep and geese and whatever else, you know, regenerative farming. I'm going to have a remedial course in English. It's so interesting. And you really get this beautiful feeling and passion and abundance from what's going on. And it's interesting to hear that from somebody who has grown up in Europe and is from the East Coast and the Midwest. And you see that and feel that. And I think that's what makes Oregon really special.
Well, here's a silly one. I was a Big Ten tailback and a long, long time ago. And
do we ask your stats?
No. But I had 10 knee operations. And when I had my knee replaced recently, not too recently, but maybe 5 years ago, one of my biggest concerns was I wanted to still be able to crawl around in the dirt and work at the vineyard. And that was one of the things when we discussed what type of knee to put in with my surgeon. That was on top of the list.
Every little boy wants to play in the dirt.
That's it. Still do.
Yeah. Little girls, too, for that matter. I mean, I was notorious for being barefoot out in the middle of the barn and the field and never having shoes on. It's very magical and energetic. So let's shift a little bit to what you planted, because you have a love for Pinot Noir. You have a love for Chardonnay, things that are definitely of that French style, I think.
Yep.
And so what went into your choices of the vineyard once you found it? Because Temperance Hill is famous. People know Temperance Hill. They know Shea Vineyard. I mean, there's these
iconic vineyards,
and you're in the same neighborhood as Temperance Hill and obviously can hit a good wedge.
And we have some great neighbors with wonderful vineyards as well. What I was focused on was what wines I really liked. There's too many to name, but one of the ones I really liked at the time was Belpont, and I loved the wines. And I liked some of the things from Adelsheim. And the wines that I liked weren't single clone wines. There's wonderful single clone wines, but the ones that I really appreciated and the ones I wanted to buy and bring home had multiple clones in them. And it just created a little more structure and diversity and nuance in the wine with all these different components blending together to make a really special wine. So we tried to find the favorite clones that I thought would help us blend a wine that I would really like. So we initially started with 10 clones of Pinot, all 1 acre blocks. And we used some heritage clones, mostly French Dijon clones, and then a couple of the old clones. We had Pommard, Vadensville, Coury. We had Mount Eden, Calera, Swan. Then I had 777, 115, 828, and 943 was one that I brought in that not many people had. It was really uneconomical to farm, but I had tasted it once, and it was just a truly velvety, really rich Pinot, and I liked it, so it fit my palate, so I wanted to plant an acre of that. And then we did, with the remaining acre, we mixed in all 10 of the clones and bought 3 more just because I was an idiot and wanted to call it Lucky 13. So we had 13 different clones in a block completely mixed in together. And we actually bottled that in 2022 by itself for the first time. So
it's like Portuguese style.
It's
that blew my mind that nobody had blocks over there. Everything was just one big cluster, 300 different varietals that are all mixed in. And of course the wine was great, but yeah.
And it's interesting because you pick that at one time. Because you can't go, it's not by rows. It's not like these two rows are this, these two rows are this, these two rows are this. They're all mixed in, complete mélange, as they say in France. And some are maybe a little too ripe, some are maybe not ripe enough, and some are perfect. And you're picking at that and watching those components come together is really interesting. And last year, or 22, excuse me, was the first year that I felt that it was strong enough that we could actually bottle that on its own. So created a goofy Lucky 13 label, and we'll see how it comes out when we release it later this year.
Is that a thing in France too, with the menage of like all these different varietals together?
Yeah, yes and no. One of the things in France that they do, they're very particular about grafting, and when they want new vines, they go to their best vines in their vineyard and take cuttings from that to create the new vines. They really want to keep it uniform and have their only their very best. I was at Bollinger over Thanksgiving in Champagne, and they have some of their original vines behind a wall, secure cameras, the whole bit, and it's in almost a pile of shred, and it runs 30, 40 yards and maybe 10 yards wide, and they're all their original vines.
Wow.
And every year they take cuttings and replant them in there and they grow them. And then when they do have to replace things in the vineyard, that's where they get the vines from.
Interesting.
And it was like, these have been there for a couple hundred years. And it's like, this is incredible. And they guard those with everything because that's the origins of their vineyard. And they want only the strongest vines from those cuttings to continue to replant their vineyard.
That is so intriguing. Now I need to go there. Need to book a trip.
It's sooner than later. It's a good trip.
I better brush up on my French. They won't appreciate my bird story or song over there, I don't think very much. Okay, so let's go back to your wine. So we've tried the Chardonnay today. We've tried the Pinot, or sorry, the Rosé, which was delicious. I just helped myself to the 524 Estate Pinot Noir. Delicious.
That's a 21, yep.
By the way. And then we have two other ones here, the Michelin, and I don't know what that one's. It's a Cuvée.
Cuvée Marie-Claude. The Estate, I think we got a 93 or 94 on that one when we threw it into one of these rating groups. But the Cuvée Marie-Claude is named after my godmother, who's my last real tie to France. And when I said we went back in Thanksgiving this year, my wife and I, we stayed with Claudie for 5 days. And she was my mother's best friend. The war did different things in Europe than it did here in the States. And my mother didn't live with her father or didn't meet her father till she was about 8 years old and lived with him at nine. And the first day of school, she became friends with Marie-Claude there, and they were best friends until the day she passed. They talked every week on Sunday when it was cheaper to make phone calls.
Way back when.
Yep. And they spent every summer together their entire lives. And then the Michelin, which is our two-barrel reserve, which we over-vintage, that's named after my mother. So Michelin and the Marie-Claude.
Very French. Tell me the difference between just these styles. What's going into them? What are the mixes? And then we'll go to the Chardonnay, because I can only imagine with having, you know, your French palate that your Chardonnay is very particular about the style.
Yes. And I would say the same about the Pinot. The Estate is it's all grown fruit. We don't buy fruit. It's all grown at Profit Vineyard. And the Cuvée Marie-Claude, we've only made twice in our two biggest harvests in 19 and then again in 22. It's a selection that I think provides a different element. I think the 22 was 100% whole cluster. I think this one might be 50% whole cluster. We're usually 20 to 30% whole cluster for the entire vintage, but in certain aspects, I goose it up. And in the Cuvée Marie-Claude, I always do. The Estate is a blend of all 10 of our blocks of Pinot. The Michelin is just two barrels. And we've done the Michelin, I want to say, four times. And it's two barrels that stand out. It's usually my absolute favorite barrel, and then one that blends very well with it. And that's the thing that's so wonderful about wine and so interesting. You taste 50 different barrels and you say, these are the two best. We agree, these are the two best. This is going to be a great wine. And you put them together and you go, it's okay. I like them both individually better than I like this together. And then you'll find something down the line that just has a different component to it or different structure, and you put it with it and you're like, that's special. And then giving it a little extra time, another 6 months to mature and round out and barrel and before you bottle it, is what we do with the Michelin. And then the Therese Marie on the Chardonnay side. And we'll be bottling those for the first time in about 2.5 weeks. So excited about that. But the Michelin, this last year, I just tasted today because we racked it. It's 100% 943, which I didn't want to do, but I did. I was telling someone earlier that it's almost decadent. It's Pinot completely, but it is so rich and opulent with a mouthfeel that's completely different. It's going to be interesting to see how it's received. I loved it, but we all have different palates. And that's another one of the neat things about wine. Nobody's ever wrong. You like that one better than I like this one, and she likes this one. We're all right, because each of our palates is unique and different, and we can all appreciate different things in different ways. The Michelin is, though, the label that I think best expresses our vineyard. I want it to have a little of the Temperance Hill Eola Amity funk. I think that's important, that forest floor with the little leaves and a little mushroom and whatnot that you can taste. I remember the first year in 17 tasting barrels, and then I finally hit one that I thought really had that. I'm like, yes, this is what I wanted. And the guy's like, really? I'm like, yeah, that's the taste I wanted. So the Michelin is the wine that I think best expresses our vineyard and what my wife and I want to produce stylistically.
So let's go back to that forest floor thing, because you say that to people, or you say it's like farm funky or something like that, and people will turn their nose up at you and go, what the hell?
Yeah.
Explain that in a way that's understandable and not super wine geek, you know, confusing. But why is Oregon Pinot like that? And what makes it special that way?
I don't know if I'm skilled enough to give that answer, but basically, when we were talking about simplifying things, and it's about going back to farming, because really, you're a grape farmer, and the better grapes you produce, the better your wine is.
1,000,000%.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you're farming, and there needs to be a taste of the earth in there. Everything has that taste. And I think it's important that you understand that these grapes weren't grown in a lab to a certain specification. And one of the neat things about Oregon, and we have three different vintages here, and they all taste different. I think that's so important. And again, I don't mean to pick on California, but there's certain vineyards, not all of them, but certain ones that you can taste they're 16 and they're 17 and they're 18 and they're 19. And the only difference is that they're a year older. They taste like the same wine. And that's a skill, and that's
a different approach.
It's a trait that some people find very valuable, that I tasted and it tastes just like it did last year. And that's important to them. In Champagne, that's incredibly important to them. But this is farming. This is Pinot. And this is a delicate, gentle fruit that we want to express the year and the vintage it came from. I want my 17 to taste a little different than my 18. We're going to use the same techniques. We're going to use the same amount of French oak and new oak that we did the year before, but it's a different grape. It's not from the same year. It isn't exactly the same, so it shouldn't taste exactly the same.
I think that's what makes the Northwest, Washington, Idaho, Oregon, not everybody, but most special in the fact that that's what they want you to taste. They want you to taste the vintage, the weather that year, how the grapes did, how they ripened, where the sugar is, how much rain we had, whatever the case is, because it makes that wine special. It makes it stick out. It makes it memorable. And when you drink the same thing over and over again, whether it comes from a box or it comes from a bottle, it's wine. And it's fine. But I think that's what I have found so interesting. And Ben Castile is the one, your neighbor. I don't know if you can hit a wedge over there, but maybe a driver.
Yeah. I can probably hit a half wedge to Bethel. But
but that was the one thing as I was learning the wine industry that I thought I needed to like every wine. Like if you liked it, I needed to like it. And I needed to have the same experience, the same flavors, the same texture. And he made it very clear that no, that's not the way this works. If you don't like this one, it's okay because we'll find one that you do. And it took so much pressure off me. Oh my God, did it take the pressure off? Because then I'm like, okay, well, I don't like this one. There's too much oak, or I don't like this one. It tastes like moss, or tastes like I licked a rock, whatever the case is. And that's, yeah.
Oh no.
The beauty of it all.
That said, Ben's much better qualified than I am to answer that question. But you look at Bethel. They have a big vineyard behind their tasting room. But there's South Block, there's West Block, and each of those taste different, yet they're not more than 25 yards apart.
Yeah.
And they all taste different. And Ben wasn't in the back mixing different chemicals and putting them in different. No, it's the grapes. The fruit is what makes it taste different. Just from being this much more out of the wind corridor and getting this much more sun in the morning.
Or the shift in the rocks down below it.
Absolutely.
I mean, or the dirt. Yeah.
That's one of the reasons we chose our property before we bought it. We did a bunch of soil samples and I was out there crawling around on my knees. One ached a great deal more. And we have both volcanic soil and marine sedimentary soil. So we've got fossilized seashells out there and we've got more volcanic rocks than I know what to do with. I'd be rich if I was in the Midwest because I could sell it to a landscaping company and we'd do great.
But is the beauty of Eola Hills is if you want boulders, there's boulders. I think we dug one up in our yard that was the size of a Volkswagen. I mean, yeah. It's just incredible. Yes.
Yeah, we have walls built all over the property mm-hmm. with them.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about experiences and how to find you. When I came up to visit, I got to meet your lovely wife, Terry, and the other French word I know, I now know what boulette means, which means meatball in mm-hmm. France, which was the little French bulldog that met me at the door. And you're not always here because you still live in Wisconsin, but people need to come in and experience what you've done, what you've made, and the property is really quite stunning.
Thank you. We're very proud of the property. We put together a little farm stand, I guess you would call it, for a tasting room. It'll be more operational this year than it was last year. Terry's here for the summer. She's a high school counselor, so she comes out for the summer and helps out at the vineyard and entertains our guests that are able to come out. We're available online at domain524.com. We're available at the vineyard in the summer and periodically throughout the year, but not often outside of holidays out here because we're both working back in the Midwest. And it's a bit of a hard climb, but we have a wonderful wine club that has grown leaps and bounds. We're hoping to expand it to the point where we don't sell very many places. My ideal was a gentleman who had a wine in California, Napa, that I met, Chanticleer. And he had a wine club with a waiting list. And he sold it to about a half a dozen restaurants nearby. So if he went out to dinner with friends, he could order his wine. And that was it. No distribution, no
nothing.
That
is like the ultimate goal.
That's the dream. But we're far away from that still. But still, that's the ultimate objective. But we're available online. We're available in Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, soon to be Florida. And there are some places here in Oregon that carry us, but not many, because I quite honestly don't have the time to go around and put my sales hat on and work it that hard out here.
There's only so much time in the day, so you got to pick and choose where you're at. Mark, thank you so very much. I know we've tried to make this happen for a couple of years, actually, and it's all about timing and Alaska Airlines and making sure that we get you to and from, and there's no ice storm. So thank you for bringing wine. Always tell Terry hello. And
I will.
And make sure that Boulette does not get picked up and flown away by some large bird.
She's protected by the two short hairs, so yes. We're okay.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yes. Hold on, everybody, because we are going to circle back around with our tasting segment again. And we have a great new snack that we're going to pair with some of the wine that we have on the table. And then we are going to bring in Chris and Akiko with Sheba Wish and Wine and talk more with them. Okay, we are back. And we are snacking with something else this time. So Heather Soprani is my chef today. We changed up a little bit because Dustin is out of town. And so she brought us some queso with some, I think she said, salsa verde in it and some chips. And so we are all about what's going to pair with this. And it's okay to crunch in the microphone because that makes it authentic and real. So we have a little bit of everything on the table. We have some whites, we've got some rosé, we've got some reds. And the whole point of this is to try to figure out what goes with all of these lovely snacking foods that nobody thinks about pairing wine with. So everybody's had their chips except for me and my cheese. Okay, what's our thoughts and why? Okay, Mark. Queso is always good. It's good with anything.
Yeah. I'd probably say the Auxerrois or the Rosé. I don't think the Pinots work with the queso as well.
Okay.
And I like the other two. The chip I grabbed wasn't very spicy, but I think the spiciness wouldn't go with, the heat wouldn't go with the red, especially the Michelin from 18. But the white and the rosé have enough acidity to make it a nice combination and nice pairing.
So why is the acidity such a big deal when it comes to something like this?
Salty, chips, cheese, pretty high fat content, pretty heavy. So the acidity is going to be, the acidity is going to cut through that. It's something we hear so much, it's almost a cliche at this point, but that palate cleansing, that acidity comes through, cleans out your palate and gets you ready for whatever is next. So
why would not a red go with this? Is it going to not cut the fat and the richness near as well? Or is it just not going to balance well?
I think you go back to balance because you're two different flavors that don't pair, as opposed to one that will pair with the other. And you talk about pairing foods. There's certain foods that go with certain wines that make just sense when you taste them together. You know, most people wouldn't have Cabernet with oysters. But if you have a...
That sounds so yucky.
It does. It does. But if you have it with a Chablis or a Loire Valley ripe, crisp Vouvray or something, it's wonderful together. You get the saltiness of the wine from the minerality in the soil and the crispness of it, and it pairs so wonderfully with the oyster, where a Pinot or a Cab, just it's two completely polar opposites.
So pairing my queso with some white wine is definitely a thumbs up.
With a good white wine or a rosé, I think you're golden.
Okay, there we go. Queso and chips, white wine or rosé, something with good acidity to cut through the fat. Okay, Mark, get out.
I'm out.
Thank you. Okay, everybody, we're back. We are full glasses, and we are on to story number two. And I said the name wrong. It is Sheba Wishern with the Kiko and Chris. How did I do that time?
Perfect.
Better? Good. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I've been stressing over that for a few days now, making sure that I pronounce that right, and I butchered it. So there we go. Nothing new, nothing, no harm foul. We fixed it. So welcome in, you two.
Thank you. I am so excited.
Yes, we are, again, international flavors on the show today in the last couple of days, and it's super cool. I have never had anybody from Japan, so welcome, welcome. I just can't wait to kind of bring you in and get your take on everything. And Chris, I had said earlier, is from New York. So let's dive into your story, because you guys were kind of all over the globe and came together with some serendipitous, I don't know.
Sure.
Interest in another country.
Okay. Well, Akiko's pointed at me, so I guess I'll start the story. At the time, I was a student working in Japan. And on the way home from work every day, I would stop in a beer bar. And this is 30 years ago, 35 years ago now. And this beer bar had over 130 different varietals that they were serving. 130 different varieties of beer.
You don't think of beer bar in Japan in the same sentence. So that kind of shocks me just in general, like that they, and then they have that many beers.
Right.
That's great.
Right. So yeah. It was a regular stop, of course. I was young. They had a lot of beer. It was a regular stop. And Akiko was my waitress. And I did that foreigner in Japan thing. And I hit on my waitress. And one thing led to another. I must have had a pretty good pickup line at the time, because here we are 35 years later in
Yowza.
Oregon. Yeah. Yeah.
I forgot this was like a romance story from like the beginning.
You can't see me rolling my eyes, unfortunately.
Yeah. Or her, for that matter. So your pickup line must have been, how was the pickup line?
I think not many Japanese people can drink a lot of alcohol. But I remember he ordered like 10 beer at the one time. And
goodness.
I remember him. Yeah.
It wasn't the pickup line.
It was the beer drinking ability that had her impressed. Okay, yeah. So you've hit on your waitress, yep. And apparently you've gotten her attention, whether it's from your vast knowledge of drinking beer and whatever else, or you might have been smoother than you thought.
Well, at the time, Akiko was doing something, and she was working on her career in Japan.
I was like editor for the cooking magazine.
Cooking magazine?
Yep.
And working in a beer bar to just...
Before I started working, when I was a college student, I was working at the beer bar. Yeah.
Got it.
And at the beer bar, the very famous editor picked me, and I worked for him for his magazine after I finished my college in Tokyo.
That's exciting.
Yeah. And... I think I worked like 2 or 3 years, but the magazine was not good sold and no more existence.
Yeah.
But this was a great job because my main task was go to the restaurant and interview. And this is not a gourmet magazine. This is more a cooking magazine. And we ask how you cook. And each month, we had one topic. And for example, 1 month, wine. Or next month, sushi or something like that. And for the topic, we collected the very famous or great chef or wine shop and interview and introduced. And I think at the time, my taste was trained.
There you go.
But no more magazine. And what should I do? And I think I had a few jobs, but Chris, he decided to go to Germany after his school.
So was Germany the next stop on the globe then?
Germany was the next stop. So while she was doing her career as an editor, I was grad schooling in America. I was in Colorado. And after Colorado, I moved to Germany to try my hand at being a scientist.
And how'd that go?
It paid the bills for a couple of years. And so Akiko came over to join me there. I was in Dusseldorf, Germany, at a little outfit called the Max Planck Institute. And while I was there, Akiko came over. And the original plan, what she left out of her story, is back in the, in the late 90s, there's this other Michael Jackson. There's a Michael Jackson beer critic, a very famous beer critic. And Akiko left out her goal of becoming the Japanese Michael Jackson. But this is a beer critic. So she came to Germany.
So dance moves.
No. Well, no. Actually, there's more stories there. So the idea of coming to Germany, fantastic opportunity to learn more about beer making, brewing, and beer in Germany. It's the, one could argue the home of Japanese-style beer, the origin of Japanese-style beer. So the original
Okay, hold on. Let's stop right there. Yeah. What is Japanese-style beer? Because to me, German beer is the Hofbrauhaus. It's Löwenbräu. It's the Pilsners that literally kick your ass when you've had too many of them, which I have. Don't remember much of Munich.
Since I dropped that one, I'll cover it.
Okay.
So the idea of the Reinheitsgebot, so the four ingredients to make beer, and this very the style, the technique of making beer, that the Japanese are, we have this cliche about them, but it's very accurate by and large, is they are great copiers and improvers. So the Japanese, when they decided they were going to start brewing their own beer, a lot of Japanese folks studied the German way of making beer and this idea of the Reinheitsgebot and some of these and brought them over to Japan. So Japanese beers are very similar in some way, much more similar to German beers than they certainly are to British ales.
Interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. Yeah. That gives me a whole new perspective on Japanese beer. Okay. Continue. I'm so sorry.
So
onward.
The idea was for her to come over to Germany and improve her beer making and her beer knowledge, because what a great place to study beer making. In order to do that on the university, you have to learn German. She didn't speak a word of, or not much German coming over, so she went to school to study German, and there she met some new friends.
Yeah, I got a good friend from Peru, and her fiancé was a German guy, and he owned a winery in Rheinhessen. Yeah, and he had also the company in Köln, in English pronunciation, Köln, but the second business, he owned also the winery. And I visited their house in Düsseldorf, and he offered Riesling, I think. That was like Auslese, the gold color Riesling. And he told me, hey, Akiko, you can also study winemaking in Germany. There is a good wine school in Germany. And I found two beer schools in Berlin and close to the Munich. These two locations was pretty far from Düsseldorf, where Chris and I were living. And the wine school was located close to the Frankfurt. This is like 2 or 3 hours from Düsseldorf. And also, beer, German beer was already very famous in Japan. At the time, I was still thinking I want to become some kind of journalist. And maybe wine journalist, German wine journalist is more interesting or more demand, you know, in Japan.
For sure.
Yeah. And I changed my goal from beer school to wine school.
That's the beautiful thing about school is you go in as one thing and you often come out as something completely different.
Yeah. And life in general, I think, more than just school, you have the best laid plans, so to speak. So
they kind of go out the window.
Yeah. Things change. So as Akiko was studying winemaking, or enology and viticulture was her degree. So it's an engineering degree in enology and viticulture. As she was studying that, I would take my vacation time and I would go and work with them. I would go, whatever they were doing in the vineyard or whatever, I would go and hang out and participate in that. And over the years there in Germany, we got to know some people. We spent a lot of time in the industry. And, you know, at some point we decided we were going to get into that industry. That was a long-term goal. We started forming the goal of my time in Germany was coming to the end. I'd been there for 6 years and I had a job offer back in the US. Akiko was still studying. So it was, hey, I'm going to go back to the US for a while. I'm going to go make some money with this new job. You come on over, you make some money, and we'll spend 4 or 5 years in North America. We'll make a bunch of money. And then we'll scoot back over to Europe because we had an offer lined up to take over a small winery in Germany. Mm-hmm. And so that was the long-term plan, was we were coming back to the US for a couple of years, make a bunch of money, and then hightail it back to Europe.
Sounds like a great plan.
It's a very romantic plan. It's also an overly naive plan.
Yeah.
Is what we learned out.
For sure.
Found out pretty quickly. So in 2006, seven, I came back to the US. Shortly after that, in 2009, Akiko came back as well. I was living in Virginia at the time when Akiko came back to the US, and her reaction to Virginia. Virginia has, I think it's, you know, top 5 or 6 wine producing states in the country. So it has a big wine industry, but Akiko was not ready to settle down in Virginia and do her career there.
Yeah. There is a good wine there, but not like here. I think each winery produced different wine. But for example, if you hear about Oregon, Willamette Valley, Pinot Noir, and now it's Chardonnay is coming. Yeah. Such an image, no image in Virginia. And after the wine school in Germany, the school was like elite school. And after the school, you should make good wine. I don't say the bad wine in Virginia, just, you know.
It wasn't your thing.
Yeah, if I work at the winery in Virginia, I cannot explain to my schoolmate, hey, Akiko, you know, after 10 years, what are you doing in the United States? Or, hey, yeah, I'm working in Virginia. And probably not many people or no one could know. And I couldn't imagine, you know,
the longevity in Virginia.
Yeah, and I asked him, hey, I cannot stay here. I have to move to somewhere. Yeah, yeah.
So where was the next stop then? So Virginia's out.
Virginia's out. It was actually pretty quick. It was pretty quick. There were really 3 options, New York, California, or 4, I guess, Oregon, Washington, right? And a lot of things pointed to Oregon. California, again, remember, our goal at this point wasn't to come out and make wine or start a winery. Our goal was to go make some money, live cheap, make a bunch of money, and run back to Europe.
That wasn't California.
That was not California, right? And New York, a native upstate New Yorker myself, the Finger Lakes, I mean, the winters are just brutal. I just could not do a Finger Lakes winter for that long. And Washington, I don't know how we wound up eliminating Washington. I think that's where it comes back to Akiko's, what her specialty was. So really colder climate, you know, Pinot Noir, everybody thinks of Germany as Riesling country, but Germany actually has a very big Pinot Noir production as well.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so Germany's so over by Baden, kind of towards France and Switzerland, there's a lot of Pinot Noir.
That
on
makes
the ground.
Sense. Yeah.
And even more in other areas like Rheingau, where Akiko was, there's more and more Pinot Noir to be found. So there was a strong connection there as well. So going someplace where her skills, where her background would be usable was obviously key.
And passion, I'm assuming, that Pinot Noir was definitely the passion. Obviously, with what's sitting on the table, aromatic whites, I'm assuming that all went hand in hand.
Yes. Yes, it was part. But again, keeping in mind that the goal wasn't to have wine sitting on the table here in 13 years or 15 years, right? We were coming out to make money. So we loaded up the same Toyota truck that we drove over here today. We loaded that truck up with everything that we owned. Yeah.
And very Clampett style.
We refer to ourselves as the Clampetts more often. People probably should.
It's so awesome.
But we loaded up the truck and we spent 2 weeks driving out to Oregon from Virginia for harvest of 2009. We'd never been to Oregon before.
Didn't you say that you had a dog in the truck too?
We had two dogs and three people in my little Toyota pickup truck.
Oh my goodness. That's a lot of crampiness in a small pickup.
For 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you all liked each other when you got out here.
We actually still talk to each other for the most part.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. So it's always interesting to me when people, you know, go somewhere blind. What were your original thoughts when you got here, since you've never been here? So was there a shock and awe factor? Was there, oh my God, I'm home? Or, oh my God, what did we just do?
That was more like escaping from Virginia.
We are not going to be very popular with Virginians after this show.
I didn't think a lot about here. You just
wanted to get here.
But I knew already about Pinot because there was a, in the school in Germany, there was a special lecture. It's like international wine. Viticulture. And the professor explained, you know, different area, and there is a good quality Pinot Noir in Oregon. And Oregon Pinot was like trendy for us as a student, you know. And actually, at the time, my sister was in Boston, and when she visited me in Germany, we asked my sister, hey, get us a few bottles of Oregon Pinot Noir and bring to us. And she did. And I remember the labels, but Edelsheim, because the label was very...
You couldn't have picked a more iconic brand for Oregon, for sure.
And also the ladies on the label, I remember the wine, And we tried the Oregon Pinot and
it's pretty good stuff. I'm super intrigued by your choice of vineyards. So you've been here for a while and you are in probably one of the most Western vineyards in the valley, correct?
Right. So we have to be careful. So where we are planting currently, we are deep into the Van Duzer corridor.
Very deep.
We are further into the Van Duzer corridor than the Van Duzer AVA is, right? So the wind has to go through our property before it hits the AVA. Is kind of how it works. And there are a couple of things that pushed us out there. I think for producers like ourselves, we're a very low budget producer. We're shoestring.
So many are.
But we wanted to be on our own facility, on our own property. And it offered that opportunity. From a cost perspective, it's the frontier. There are some great other producers out there. There's a new vineyard right behind us. Art and Science is right down the road from us. I can't believe I almost forgot their name. It seems like there's a little bit more coming into the area now. Ransom there has a vineyard and an old production facility right down there as well. It works for us. The soil is a mixture of, it's a little bit of volcanic and a little bit of sedimentary as well. I think that's the case in a lot of places in the valley, but we've got a good mixture up there. But the weather and the elevation are great. It's coolish climate up there. It's windy and it's wet and it's cold, which is great these days.
So the million-dollar question is, what are you planting up there? Because not everything's going to really like that spot at this point. With climate change, it's going to change. But you've brought some beautiful wines, which are probably not from property yet. They're not estate yet. Gorgeous. We'll talk about that here in a second. But what are you planting? I know you plant some Riesling because I saw you with some of my favorite people the other day.
Right. There's a lot going in up there. We're rolling the dice a little bit. on several levels. We're rolling the dice a lot. We've decided to do a lot of things that people making a large commercial vineyard would pull out their spreadsheets and say that we're doing it all wrong. Because first of all, you mentioned it earlier, we're going as regenerative as we can.
I'm so glad you can say that word, because I sure cannot.
Practice. Yes. We are also planting, I think I counted the other day, we're up to, including clones, I think we're at like 20 different types of grapes up there. Pretty close.
Love it.
The goal is to make a white field blend. So there are some red grapes, there's Pinot Meunier and Pinot Noir mixed in there as well. But the goal is for it all to go into a white blend. But there's also some varietals that you don't find too often. There's some Kerner and some Rieslana, as well as a Japanese clone we've got up there, some Koshu as well, which is a pink grape, which is a kind of wild pink grape. So we'll find out. We think that the varietals should be happy up there in the cold, wet air. We're going to have to work hard to keep them healthy and keep them growing cleanly. But we think the lower temperature and the winds should give us a wine with some great acidity and some nice naturally low alcohol, and balance it out with some early ripening grapes that give us some nice, just a little bit of a fruity component. Good balance. It's all about balance. So a lot of different things. Or we're going to fall flat on our faces and completely blurry.
No, that's not the case. I'm so excited because I love great white wine, and it's just not given as much. It's, you know, in my mind, before I really got into this, white wine was the beginner's wine. And it's so complex. It's so beautiful. It can pair with so many different things and just isn't given enough accolades as it should. So when I saw you bringing two bottles of white wine, I'm like, ooh, I don't know what's in that bottle, but I'm going to like it. And I can't pronounce it. Mark can pronounce it because it's French, but they're both blends, are they not?
So we brought two white wines. So
yes.
So they're, one of them is 100% Ossois. So that's an Alsatian varietal.
Mm-hmm. Assois.
So again, not a Francophone myself either, but it's A-U diphthong in front is an O. So yeah. Ossois is the correct start out there. That's 100% Ossois is the first one. And the second one is a blend of Ossois, Pinot Noir as rosé, and Pinot Gris as well. So
how
it's a blend of three and then 100% Ossois.
So what else are you making? We brought a Pinot Noir as well.
So we do those white varietals, Pinot Noir, and as of 2021. Chardonnay started in 22.
Ah, Chardonnay 22.
Yeah, we do. We have notes for all of this. That's why we keep notebooks. The 22 was our first Chardonnay vintage. So that's not on the table yet because it literally just got bottled. So they're letting it bottle age a bit. But so Chardonnay, Ossois, Pinot Gris, and Pinot Noir. That's the
lovely lineup.
Yeah. And we are, in the end, we are still a Pinot house. I mean, our biggest production run is of about 700 cases total. 600 cases total of Pinot Noir. That's our biggest production still. So the white is minor. It's about a third of that currently. But Pinot Noir is still king in Oregon.
It is still king in Oregon. So have the dreams been realized? You're happy here. It's not Virginia. And hopefully you're not going anywhere for a while.
I don't think so. What do you think?
After retired, maybe I move to somewhere, but yeah, coming 20 years, I'm here.
We're going to have to put her in like the, what is that, when you've been testified against the mafia.
Protective custody.
Yeah, protective custody. We're going to have to change her name. And I got a great plastic surgeon you can go visit and change your nose or something, you know, to where you're non-identifiable.
Yeah.
So for those Virginians out there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and we've got to stick around long enough to see those grapes start producing some fruit. Right?
Oh,
so we're locked in for a while.
For sure. I actually am hoping you extend me an invitation when things start really rolling, because I think it's so interesting when people are doing cool things like that. So anyhow, we need to figure out how to spell the name of the winery so we can find you online and social media and all those things.
Okay, so it's Sheba Wishern, and you can find us on Instagram is the place where we're most active. Online, we are at www.ShebaWishernCellars. And Sheba, her name, that's her family name, that's Akiko's family name, is S-H-I-B as in boy, A as in apple. And Wishern, that's me, is WICHERN, Robert November for RN, Sellers.com. Sheba Wishern Sellers.com.
I'm actually really glad that you specified that because I meant to ask you what the name meant and I neglectfully left that out. So thank you for doing my job for me.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you both for bringing the wine and being part of my crazy tasting experience and just sharing your story with all of us because it's lovely. It's fun. It's a love story, which I had actually forgotten about. You told me that over beer and I apparently had like somehow forgot that you had hit on her at the beer bar. So, and he'll never live it down. It's out there now. So thank you everybody for listening.
Thank you.
As always, we appreciate everybody who listens to us and shares our story. Please go on and subscribe and rate as well. And as always, a huge thank you to my audio guy, Daniel with South of Autumn Productions. We have a different chef today with Heather Soprani. You can go to her website, heathersoprani.com, for catering and anything food related. She's quite amazing. And all of you for listening to our craziness. So cheers. Pour yourself another glass of wine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She's a little bit crazy.